This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Before the advent of services like Netflix, chances are you'd get a movie recommendation from a friend or a family member or a cinema geek at a video store. Remember those? Today, Netflix knows your viewing habits and preferences and increasingly influences your choice in films. Its recommendation system steers customers to purchases and downloads based on their shopping track record. Today in Radio Times, you might also like. We're talking about how online recommendations shape the movies we watch, the books we read, the music we enjoy, even the people we date. We have two guests who have joined us, and here in our Philadelphia studios is Kartik Hosaniger. He's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, where his research focuses on the digital economy. And nice to have you with us from Radio Times.
Marty, thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And joining us by telephone is Clayton Critcher. He's an assistant professor of marketing, cognitive science, and psychology at the University of California at Berkeley at the Haas School of Business. And he researches how people make judgments and decisions in economic, moral, and political contexts. And Clayton Critcher, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty, for having me on the show.
You're very welcome. Kartik, let me begin with you and begin with some very sort of simple, basic questions. Let's say I'm on Amazon. I want to buy a toaster. What happens next? If we're talking about recommender systems, what's the process or the technology that's at work?
Yeah, so let's talk about Amazon in particular, and then I'll generalize this discussion a little bit. So at Amazon, once you go to the website, the first thing Amazon does, even before you go search for a toaster, is to see what are some products you've bought before, what are some products that you've been looking at recently. So it gives you two kinds of recommendations on its homepage. The first is going to be based on your past purchases, and it's going to say people like you also like this. And so it's going to recommend some other products that are similar to products you've purchased in the past. The second kind of recommendations are recent views. So that's just trying to remind you, here are some products you've looked at recently, but you did not buy, so maybe you're ready to buy them. Now, that's very generic, and that doesn't account for your current context. And then you run a search, you say, I'm looking for a toaster, you'll go look at a toaster. That's where Amazon was going to start making recommendations like, people who viewed this also viewed this, or people who bought this also bought this. So it's trying to both tell you, here are other products, other toasters you might be interested in, but they'll also tell you, people who bought toasters also bought these other appliances along with the toasters.
And so, obviously, Amazon knows how we shop and has decided that we are a certain kind of person. A person that bought a toaster might also like this kind of pair of shoes or might like a certain kind of cell phone.
That's exactly right. At the heart of any of these personalization or what are known as recommender systems is creation of a persona. So they're all trying to create a persona. Different companies create personas in different ways. So Amazon might create a persona in a more what they call collaborative way. Mm-hmm. So this is called a collaborative filter, meaning they're trying to find other people whose purchases or preferences are like yours. Some other companies like Pandora, which is a music recommendation service, it's essentially an online radio that personalizes the radio station. They're not necessarily trying to find other people like you, but nonetheless, they create a persona by looking at songs you've liked, and they find other songs with similar attributes. So they've maybe created a persona and said, you tend to like jazz music songs or music that's very rhythmic, has good meter to it, and they might find other things with similar characteristics.
Clayton, I want to turn to you in a second, but one more question for you, Kartik, which is this then, it's algorithms, right? That's how Amazon knows what kind of toaster I would like to buy.
Absolutely. It's all algorithms. There's no way to scale personalization in an online setting unless you turn to algorithms. You cannot have human beings sit and
right,
look
watching
at the data.
Me purchase this.
Right, exactly. So the only way this works is they're trying to figure out, you know, if we go back 10, 15 years when they designed these systems, they're essentially trying to go back and figure out this person at the store, at the CD store that you walk into, who recommends a CD to you, or at a bookstore who recommends a book. What is it that they're going through, the sequence of steps? in order to make a recommendation to you. And then they're trying to automate those steps and create algorithms that do that.
Clayton Critchard, let me get you in on the conversation. I mean, would it be fair to to say that Amazon knows my preferences better than I do?
I think that's a really interesting question that sort of gets at the heart of, you know, do we have real preferences when it comes to what it is that we're going to enjoy? So some of the things that I've been looking at, along with my collaborators in this space, is how is it that once we get recommendations on what it is that we're going to like, how does that actually affect then the subsequent experience that we have with those products or services? So, for example, if I'm told by Netflix that I'm especially likely to enjoy a movie, that may actually change and make me more likely to think that I'm enjoying the movie as I'm watching it than I would have had I not received that recommendation. In fact, recently, sort of after this big brouhaha over Facebook's revelation that it experimented on its users,
right.
OkCupid revealed that they've done similar experiments where they were giving users false feedback that they had stronger matches with potential dating partners than the data they had actually suggested that they did. And what they found was that those false recommendations actually produced a self-fulfilling prophecy. So if I was told that I was matched 90% with someone else, not only was I more likely to contact that person, but that conversation was actually likely to continue. So it wasn't just that I learned that actually we didn't have a lot in common, but that recommendation actually fed forward and contaminated, so to speak, my experience such that I thought I was enjoying it more than I would have without that recommendation.
I mean, the idea is it sort of confirms a decision, or it says other people would do this, therefore you're not alone in making this decision?
So it may be that there's sort of always ambiguity. So if you return to the dating context, there's always ambiguity about whether a date is going well or whether you have good chemistry or match with someone else. And so these recommendations may be one source of input that actually leads us to think that we're enjoying something more than we would have thought otherwise. So it may just change the way we interpret at a very low level the experiences that we're having.
Let me turn back to you, Kartik. And as you know, there's a controversy about whether these recommender sites narrow our choices and sort of limit our access to, let's say, movies or music or maybe even politics, or whether it actually doesn't work that way. And I'd be curious about your analysis of that and even some of your conclusions.
Yeah, so I think there have been several concerns that these systems might create echo chambers where you hear more and more of what you like, and so it narrows your horizons and your media consumption and so on. And I think in theory that's possible. Certainly it's possible to design an algorithm that does that. It can find out that you like a certain kind of music or a certain kind of book, or even in political context, a certain kind of news story, and
exactly.
Then just go in and just focus only on that. But in practice, what I've found in a lot of my research is that most systems don't do this. You know, if you think about it, at the heart of recommendations is not to suggest something that is relevant to you. It's actually to aid discovery. So it's not just telling you, here's another book that's relevant, because probably you knew about this other book that's very close to your preference. It's really to find out this other new novel thing that would be a good fit for you, but you didn't know about it. So at the heart of discovery is exploration. So what I have found is that several common recommender designs, like the Amazon mm-hmm. one where it says people who bought this also bought this, or the Pandora one that says, given you like this kind of music, here are other similar songs, they actually expand your horizons. And the way they do that is they'll find this one product that is reasonably close to what you like, but it's also got something new in it. And that serves as a bridge to new interests. So in books, there might be maybe you like thrillers, and it's going to find a certain thriller, but it's got a political angle to it, and maybe the thrillers you've been reading haven't been political thrillers. They were psychological thrillers. And now you suddenly get interested in politics. Or in music, maybe you are listening to classic rock, and there's this new recommendation that slowly takes you from classic rock to more modern rock, and then eventually perhaps to very different areas as well.
I want to pick up on that, but let me give you, Clayton Critcher, a chance to respond to that, or even respond to the question about whether these recommenders do limit, or whether, as Kartik was describing, sort of opens up possibilities to us that we might not have thought of before.
Yeah, so I definitely agree with Kartik that that there is this this positive benefit of helping you seek variety and diversifying what you're exposed to. One distinction that we've been thinking about is whether that's a diversity that leads you toward new experiences that you would have naturally found anyway, or whether it would have been very unlikely that you would have found that had it not been for the recommendation system. And I think that actually comes back to a distinction that Kartik brought up earlier between what's called these content-based systems or these systems that rely on collaborative filtering. So the content-based systems are those sort of like Pandora, where they identify that you like certain elements. So maybe Pandora learns that I like pop R&B songs that involve a shift in key, and then recommends other songs that have those features. And as Kartik mentions, maybe through the exploration of those other songs, I'm likely to able to discover other mm-hmm. features that I also enjoy. I guess one thing that we've looked at there, though, is that maybe those are the types of songs that I would have naturally gravitated toward anyway, because there are surface level similarities that, as long as I was open to exploration, those are the types of things I might have looked at. One thing that can be different about these collaborative filtering systems is they can make recommendations merely because other people have said that they like things that I myself have said that I liked. And as a result, recommendations can come that on the surface, there's not necessarily any obvious reason why this has been recommended. And I think those are the types of products that or experiences that we're less likely to spontaneously gravitate toward without the benefit of the recommendation system. So I think across the board, you can get this nice benefit of being exposed to new things, but I think that may be especially true for those collaborative filtering systems.
And we're almost having a break here, but I mean the convenience angle, which is, let's say you are online, you know, and this stuff is coming at you in a way, which is very different, not to say that people don't ask their friends, you know, what books are you reading that you enjoy, but the convenience of it just seems to be a pretty powerful tool, Clayton.
Absolutely. So not only is it convenient on the consumer's end to be exposed to those recommendations, but I mean, what aids this process is it's so much easier now for consumers to give that real-time feedback. As you're listening to the song, you can thumbs up or thumbs down it. As you're changing your Netflix queue, it's easy to put a star rating on the last movie that you watched. Whereas in the past, this might have involved sending consumers postcards or, you know, bothersome phone calls to get feedback on experiences. And now it's much easier to do this sort of market research real time.
Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about something called recommender systems. They're everywhere online when browsing for books or movies, music, clothes, news, even dates. Talking with Clayton Critcher and Kartik Hosinger. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Holman Cadillac proudly supports WHYY. During Holman Cadillac Summer's Best event, over 200 of the season's collection of new and pre-owned Cadillacs are available for a test drive. More at Holman Cadillac on Route 73 in Mount Laurel, New Jersey, and online at HolmanCadillac.com.
This week on This American Life, Josh visits the mean girl he knew in elementary school, and she's still mean.
They look right at you and say, I know you're garbage. You know you're garbage. Why pretend? And you're going to come over to my house, which is the biggest house I've ever seen in my life. And you're going to say, you see this garbage? This is what a real man provides for me.
Some people never get over it. The allure of the mean friend.
You know, you come here and you tape me for your stupid friend's radio show, and then you get the hell out.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. The Giver author Lois Lowry likes the film version of her book, even though it's a different futuristic society than the one she imagined.
Having grown up on military bases, I think that's the kind of rigidly ordered community that I had in my mind. When I saw the houses they had created for the community, I thought, oh, of course.
Next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
WHYY's Keystone Crossroads, stories of reinvention as Pennsylvania's cities face rust or revival. Join the conversation at whyy.org/keystonecrossroads. Made possible by a generous grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're just joining us, we're talking about how the Internet is telling us what music we like and what books we'd like to read, perhaps what we'd like to buy, and perhaps even who we'd like to date. And our guests are Kartik Hosaniger, and he's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School, where his research focuses on the digital economy. And by phone, Clayton Critcher. He's an assistant professor of marketing, cognitive science, and psychology, and that's at the University of California's Berkeley campus, the Haas School of Business. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Kartik, it looked like you wanted to say something right before we hit that break.
Yeah, I was actually, I wanted to second some of what Clayton said in terms of, first, the distinction between two different kinds of algorithms. One is the collaborative algorithms, like the kind that Netflix and Amazon use that are based on what others are consuming. And the second is what are called content-based algorithms, which is what Pandora uses, that's based not so much on what others are consuming, but really asking what other songs are similar to what you like. And I think, you know, the collaborative algorithms may have more of a tendency to get locked in certain feedback loops or echo chambers wherein somebody liked it, therefore now it's recommended to you, now you like it, therefore it's recommended to somebody, and so on. So what happens is that a great product that's just right for you, a great song that's just right for you, which hasn't yet been discovered by others, would simply not be recommended by that collaborative application or recommender, whereas a content-based recommender has a chance of finding some of those. And some of your listeners might have experienced this. On Pandora, sometimes you'll get these songs that are a little bit out there in the sense that, you know, I didn't even
know
this.
What is this doing here?
Yeah, exactly. What is this song? I didn't even know it exists. Whereas with Amazon or Netflix, you're likely to find more familiar recommendations. And so there is that difference. But having said that, I will say that you know, one area where maybe I differ not a whole lot, but a little bit from Clayton is that while these systems may sometimes recommend stuff that you will anyway eventually find, for one, they help you find that faster. And second, in a lot of our studies, we've found that they also find you stuff that you wouldn't otherwise find. So, for example, in one study with music where we looked at, we had a control group where we're tracking them over a period of time who have not got these recommendations, and then another group that are getting these recommendations. And we saw these people who are getting the recommendations over a period of 3 to 4 months start to explore new genres. So overall, the number of music genres they were listening to was greater than the people who were otherwise similar but we're not getting these recommendations. So we did see some of that.
Clayton, going back to you, I mean, just as a reminder, if we're talking about music and books and movies, and essentially it's, I mean, it is about a purchase. It's people trying to sell us stuff and trying to sell us stuff, I guess, in the most pinpoint, maybe even psychological way.
That's right. And I think that brings up one interesting factor. So one thing that we've looked at is the confidence that consumers place in recommendations that are made to them. So one thing that is important is, and one thing that can be a benefit to the content-based system, is if there's some rationale or reason that the consumer sees why this was recommended to them, that comes across as more compelling. So in the content-based case, where Pandora can actually tell you what features of the song that maybe you liked in other songs and why they've recommended this, that can help to actually make that recommendation seem more compelling. And although we don't have data on this last point, I would imagine then more likely to actually act on. But again, that's a more tentative conclusion.
But it sounds like what you're both saying in sort of different ways is that and perhaps this is better to you, Clayton Critcher, which is that people want to choose something that they feel other people have chosen. Perhaps it feels like the safe choice, or it's to be part of the in crowd, or to choose something that is popular.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting you said the word safety there. So we've looked at and thought about this as a safe choice in a slightly different way than just sort of a conformity type of motive. Instead, what we find, and this is in work that I've done with a now Stanford PhD student, Porus Kambada, we've looked at attention that consumers feel when sort of they have an intuition that they think they would like a certain product, but a recommendation pushes them or suggests something else that intuitively they're not sure as much that they would like. Mm-hmm. And so the way that many consumers then represent that choice is they see sort of the recommended product as the potentially safe option. It's unlikely to be a total bust, but it may not be exactly what they're thinking that they would really love. Whereas if they just go with their own intuitions and ignore the recommender systems, they see that as taking more of a risk. It may end up to being a complete bust, or maybe exactly what they love. So we've been exploring different factors that makes consumers more or less risk-averse and therefore more or less likely to lean on those recommender systems.
But even in the analog world, I mean, we do turn to our friends, family, coworkers, people that we respect and like, and say, you know, did you enjoy that TV show? Did you enjoy that movie? Did you enjoy that book, that trip, that date? I mean, it's, you know, we... This just seems like it's the same kind. I'm looking at you, Kartik, obviously, the same kind of thing, but just it operates in the digital world.
I think it's exactly the same thing. We are looking for validation. We're looking for inputs from our friends. And I think what a lot of research shows, it not only helps us with discovery and feel something is safe, but it also affects our post-consumption experience or sense of that experience. So in other words, if you told me you really liked this song and I heard the song, it would change my perception of the song. And in fact, there was this great experiment done, and I'm sure Clayton is very familiar with this, by Matt Salganik, who's a professor at Princeton, and a bunch of his colleagues, where they had a bunch of people listen to songs, and all they did was show a bunch of previously unknown songs to them, ordered them randomly, and you kind of eventually decided what you wanted to buy. And another group got the same songs, but you also knew how many times these songs had been downloaded by people before you. And just that simple piece of information, knowing how many times each song had been downloaded before you, changed the way the market worked. Hits became really big mega hits in that market, where people just started gravitating increasingly towards previously downloaded songs. And also it became very unpredictable about who would actually win that market, because it just depended on these chance events, like the first few people ended up liking this one song, which created this cascade, and that song became this mega hit in that market.
And let me quickly reintroduce you. That's Kartik Hosaniger, and he's a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School. His research focuses on the digital economy. Also with us, Clayton Critcher. He's an assistant professor of marketing, cognitive science, and psychology at the University of California at the Berkeley campus at the Haas School of Business. And we are talking about how the internet influences what we read, what we download, what we watch on TV, what movies we watch as well. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. We do have a tweet from Anthony, and it looks like you did your homework, Kartik. You looked this up very quickly. He wanted to know about your guest's opinion on the new version of Foursquare.
Yeah,
and you have the answer, because you looked it up just about a second ago.
Yeah, but I just have very briefly looked at the new Foursquare app. So at the high level, what I can see is that Foursquare has really gone in the direction of not just allowing check-in. So for listeners who are not very familiar, Foursquare is an app where once you go to a restaurant, you kind of check in at the restaurant and your friends get to find out about that. But now what they're trying to do is to not just allow you to just find out and check into restaurants and so on, but really discover what restaurants and what local businesses do your friends really love or like or go to often. So there are essentially in some ways doing what Yelp does.
Right.
But Yelp essentially does this with reviews, and the idea is you have to go through reviews, a lot of reviews, and figure out what you like. And they want to try and make this process easier and faster, but just knowing which restaurants are your friends checking into often and getting recommendations through these friend check-ins. So essentially trying to use, again, social information to make restaurant recommendations and other kinds of local business recommendations, whether it's a salon or a spa. And it's the same idea, yeah, where your friends are not going to have an influence on your choices, and these kinds of cascades and feedback loops we'll see a lot more of.
Let me get Stacy from Hopewell, New Jersey, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Stacy. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi there.
I wanted to share with you my experience on Match.com.
Sure.
Because it was the exact opposite of what the gentleman was talking about before. I was told that this one man was not my match. He did not meet my criteria. And I guess people in relationships can be accused of maybe not knowing exactly what they want or what's best for them. And they filtered his email to me into my other email box. They still let me see it,
right,
but they sent it to me as if it was somebody I wasn't going to be interested in. And he even said to me, you know, Match says I'm not meeting your criteria, but I just had to say, you know, he made a comment about something I had written in my profile. And just something happened where our communication was just right on, and we have so much in common that if I were to determine him percentage-wise, he would be like 95% my match. And, you know, even on my way out to dinner, I knew that Match was saying, you know, this is not going to be the guy for you. And we're still together a year later.
Well, good for you, Stacey. It's a great call, raises a number of questions, and I'll start with you, Clayton, which is, do people really profile themselves accurately? And what are the, you know, what's the track record of some of these sites, including Match.com?
Yeah, so, I mean, I think this in part brings up the issue of what's a realistic standard for how good can you expect a recommendation system to be. So usually those people who are looking at this, especially from an academic side, we're already going to be impressed just as soon as you can start to make any recommendations that go beyond chance. Of course, that's not the end goal. But I think many people, sometimes in the general public, are thinking that these have much, much higher accuracy than they actually do. And so, for example, people who in this OkCupid experiment, who actually only had a 30% match, for those who reached out once, I think about 10% of those were still talking after four more messages. So certainly not to say that it's impossible to find love, even with those that the recommendation system predicts that you won't, just because these systems are very imperfect. That's one reason why several years ago Netflix had a big $1 million challenge to try to improve their recommendation system performance by 10%, which is that might sound like a pretty modest goal, but that's pretty hard to achieve.
Go ahead, Kartik.
Yeah, I just wanted to add that at some level, when you're designing these algorithms, we have to recognize that what these algorithms are trying to do, or the designers are trying to do, is trying to be right most of the time with most of the people. And so when you're trying to be right most of the time with most of the people, you're not going to be exactly right with one person. So you make compromises there because you're trying to design an algorithm that kind of works with your entire user base. So you're always going to run into situations where your recommendations are pretty good, but they're not amazing because of that reason. And one of the things that I've found is also that it helps to throw in a bit of randomness into these recommendations. So while the recommendations is saying, here's the top preferred item, here's the second most preferred item, and so on, throw in some randomness, pull out an item just out of the blue and say, here's a song you might like, And those are sometimes really valuable. And we've found those random recommendations, people actually seem to like those if you just label them as, here's a recommendation that's personalized for you. It's random, but they seem to like it.
But are you both also saying that there are, that people are in some ways predictable? That you can create a profile that works maybe not 100% of the time, but maybe 75% of the time. That if you like this, you probably like that, and then you'll like that, and read this, and go to this restaurant. I'm looking at you, Carter.
Absolutely. I think people are predictable if the yardstick is, you know, I need to be right 70-75% of the time. And if the yardstick is, I know you inside out and I'll be always right, you know, even you
well,
don't know yourself.
Yeah, well,
exactly. Even you don't know yourself inside out. So, you know, we ourselves don't know what we want. So it's hard for an algorithm to do that. But it can be pretty good.
Do you agree, Clayton?
Yeah, I think for some people that predictability can sound somewhat threatening. It sounds like it threatens some of their individuality of their preferences. But I mean, I think it's important to remember there that even if everyone is different and unique in what constitutes their preferences, there'll still be different clusters or types of people that can be characterized by reasonably well by a single type of overall system.
Let me get Mark from Upper Derby to join our conversation. Hi, Mark. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi,
good
there.
Morning.
Good morning.
I'd like to please ask if your guests see the possibility of virtual focus group software coming to the market in the next 5 years. I want to test my website, my novel I'm writing, anything I create against a hypothetical group before I create it.
A virtual focus group. Kartik, can you take that?
Yeah, so I think the idea is that you're coming up with some kind of a product. In this person's instance, it's a novel or something that he's writing or some product he's coming out with. And you're trying to see if there's an audience for that and will people respond to that before you spend a lot of time and money on this. And there has been a lot of work in this area, including online, where a lot of companies will create product ideas and will test it with users. I'll give you one example. There's a well-known gaming company called Zynga. And
sure.
Something that they used to do was, before they actually build a game, they write up what is the high concept of the game. They create a Facebook ad for that game. And when you click on that ad, you go to a landing page where that game is described. And it says, thank you for your interest. The game isn't yet ready, but if you are interested, enter your email address here. Now, all they're doing is they've described the game. So maybe the game was a hospital simulation game. They ran an ad, and now they'll see, out of every 100 people who were shown the ad, what proportion of them clicked on the ad. Then they'll also see, out of every 100 people that clicked on the ad and came to the website, what proportion of them entered their email address. And they'll look at those numbers, and they'll compare it with their games in the past that have been hits and say, do these numbers match up? If so, we're ready to build this. That's the virtual focus group your listener is asking about. That's an example, but absolutely, there's a lot of companies doing really interesting things with that online.
We're almost up in a break here, but didn't Netflix do a version of that in terms of downloading or creating some of the TV show, the political TV show, so trying to figure out what people would like to watch and then giving it to them?
Yeah, exactly. That's another great example. So Netflix started getting into the content creation side, and they said,
House of Cards, that's what I was looking for, yes.
Right. And they said, look, we know a lot more about what users want than your average studio, because we're seeing what people are searching for on Netflix, we're seeing how they're browsing, so we know what they're actually looking for, so we'll create something along the lines, and it looks like it worked out really well for Netflix. So that's another great virtual focus group, in a sense.
We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation, talking with Kartik
Hosanagar.
I practice it all wrong, so Hosanagar. He's with us here in Philadelphia, and by telephone, Clayton Critcher. And we're talking about what are called recommender systems, how the Internet is telling us what to buy and what we like. 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Chapin School, a pre-K through 8th grade independent school in Princeton, supports WHYY. With small classes and high academic expectations, Chapin students receive personal attention from a faculty dedicated to helping them succeed academically. Chapin's focus on the virtues of respect, responsibility, honesty, kindness, and perseverance seeks to nurture students with a strong moral fiber. Chapin students also demonstrate strong abilities in the arts, music, sports, and technology. More at chapinschool.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Jonathan Weissman, who covers Congress for the New York Times.
This is a Congress that really is doing nothing.
Weissman says by all measurements, laws passed, days in session, issues dealt with, this sharply divided Congress is the least productive in history. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Going backwards in Iraq with blinders on.
At this point, I think there's a reluctance even to want to know, both among the public and in the administration. It's just too much of a nightmare to be dragged back into this country, and yet that's what's happening.
Writer George Packer on Baghdad's shrinking influence and an Iraqi future that looks more like Bosnia's violent past. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wain. We are talking about recommender systems. They are just about everywhere online. Sites like Amazon and Pandora and Netflix use them to make suggestions to customers, hoping to steer them to a purchase. We're talking about whether these systems end up pigeonholing people, narrowing the shopping choices, or do they make it easier to shop and download by knowing what we like. We're looking at the hyper personalization of online content, and again talking with Kartik Hosanagar, and his work focuses on the digital economy. He works at the University of Pennsylvania, and Clayton Critcher, he looks at how people make judgments and decisions at the University of California at Berkeley. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Clayton, if I can go back to you and even go back to something that was referenced earlier in the hour, which is how we get our news online, and I know that you look at political context, and I think anyone that uses Google a lot to get their sort of trying to figure out what's going on in the news, Google sort of reads the kind of news that we're interested in and then fine-tunes some of our choices there. Help us understand, I guess, what's going on in the political realm.
Yeah, so in fact, as you allude to, that there's a concern that we now basically expose ourselves to media of especially one political bent or persuasion. So in fact, I've turned off all of the filters on my Google News so that I don't get any personalized content. Uh-huh. Otherwise, I'm afraid that I would only get one type of news. I think the danger that comes from being exposed to different content is made all the more apparent when you look at research from social psychology that has looked at how people can actually respond to the exact same content in different ways. So in a classic psychology study, liberals and conservatives were exposed to a research story about the death penalty that had some mixed evidence about whether it was actually a deterrent for crime or not. And then basically both groups came away even more convinced of their original opinion. So if we can look at the exact same news story and essentially become more sure of what we already believed, you can see how that can be all the more problematic if we're only looking at things that already explicitly speak to the opinions and support those opinions that we already have.
That's that confirmation bias thing, right?
Exactly.
But, I mean, it seems to me that this also happens offline as well. People, you know, gravitate to, let's say, Fox News and MSNBC or other places where they get their news or perhaps even where they get their politics.
Absolutely. So people are doing that intentionally because we do enjoy hearing other people essentially parrot the opinions that we already have. And so if you're using a single online news source, like let's say an aggregator like Google News, you might hope that that would lead you to be exposed to a diversity of opinions, but actually as those algorithms become more sophisticated, that may not be entirely the case.
We have a tweet from Mark. This is to you. Kartik says, Pandora's recommendations made me switch to Spotify when it kept playing the same songs I disliked.
Mm-hmm. So it's hard to say exactly what happened there. It's possible Pandora got his persona or his profile wrong, but I suspect it's another issue which is actually very common. I've heard this from several folks who've used Pandora, and it has to do, I think, with the way Pandora's algorithms are designed. So unlike Amazon, it's not based on other people like you are listening to this this kind of music. It's based on here are other songs which have very similar profiles to songs you like. And what happens as a result is that Pandora is more likely to play songs that are a little unfamiliar than a collaborative algorithm which will play you songs others are listening to. And as a result, what happens is that I think when you're listening to unfamiliar songs and you're hearing this for the first time, you're less likely to appreciate it. I think there's, with music, you know, I think familiarity helps. Listening to a song or that kind of tune a couple times, the third time is when it really hits you. And I think Pandora, the lack of a collaborative element may be doing some of that.
I mean, is it listening to this person likes a certain kind of rhythm or a certain kind of vocal performance? I mean, how granular can it get?
Yeah, they started based on this project that was called the Music Genome Project. So they had artists listening, musicians listening to songs and rate these songs along, I forget, it was certainly over 80 different attributes that they call genes. And those things are things like, you know, how rhythmic is the song, you know, the meter in the song, is it, is there a guitar? If so, what kind of, you know, strings are we hearing and so on. So they broke it down and they had actual musicians sit and rate these songs. So I think they've got pretty rich data on the songs and what songs are similar and so on. But at the same time, like I said, you know, you're going to hear the song, which, you know, a hardcore musician is going to listen and say, yes, this is what's similar. But, you know, somebody like me is going to listen to this song and I'm going to say, I'm not sure what's similar between those two songs. And furthermore, I've never heard this. So it's not familiar.
Thumbs down, right?
Yeah, thumbs down. That's what happens, I think.
Clayton, just a quick question to you, then we'll get back to our callers. I mean, it seems we can be so preferential these days. We can be very specific about what we like and what we don't like. And I'm not saying that's a good thing or a bad thing, but it seems that's sort of grown out of what we've been talking about.
Yeah, and in fact, you see as a consumer trend that's been going for a number of years, interest in customization. So having not just the standard version of the product, but the product that is shifted in all the ways to match our specific preferences. One thing I've noticed more recently is our brands that are sort of taking advantage of what I sometimes think of as an illusion of customization. So one major jeans manufacturer, you can go to their website and answer a bunch of questions about your body type, and they suggest what seems to be a very specific, personally tailored version of their jeans for you. Now, in actuality, they just have four types of jeans, but they've given an illusion that essentially they are choosing one of the 128 you know, types that match your answers to all the questions. So I think part of it is just we like the feeling that what we are consuming is something that's been very personalized for us.
Very, very tailored for our particular taste. Kartik, did you want to answer that? Then we'll get to our callers.
No, I think Clayton makes a great point. I think there is a strong, what I might call a placebo effect here. So just being told here's a personalized recommendation, you know, makes us feel nice about it, makes us choose this. We have actually seen this in some experiments we've run with companies where we have recommendations and we were saying, here's a personalized recommendation, but we're picking a product at random.
Yeah.
And people respond to that. So there's no doubt there's a placebo effect here.
Let me get to, looks like Bob from Center City, Philadelphia, to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Bob. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Morning. Hi,
morning.
Everyone. I was in college radio in undergrad, and I also was a lawyer in entertainment law briefly. And when I was in college, one of the ways bands got popular is by giving them on-air play. So eventually the popularity was based upon various regions of the country getting airplay and that bleeding over to the next region through college radio. So right now my concern is that these different types of media and their recommendations, you know, based upon your guest studies, are creating pseudo-stars. They're being generated by these marketing groups. By giving heavy play and saying buy this, it doesn't necessarily mean it's a quality group and or sound that has been filtered by a group of people. So that's my concern. It's like popularity versus quality. The next thing is, how are royalties being tracked in all these different medias, and how can anyone make money? I mean, a lot of artists complained about this 5-10 years ago, but if you don't have star quality, like superstar quality, it's kind of hard to make your money.
Yeah,
so I guess it's Mike. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say we've done whole shows about that, about how musicians make money these days, and that's a much deeper conversation. But just a quick question to you, though, Bob. I mean, radio stations would, and still do to this day, they pick what you listen to. So what is the difference?
Yes. So that the difference with that is that college radio eventually filters into the mainstream media and the mainstream radio. So back in the 80s, it was groups like U2, REM, The Clash. They weren't getting on-air play from commercial stations until college radio introduced them to it. And that's really how a lot of music got introduced into the mainstream, was through college radio.
I hear you.
And that, right now, you're creating this pseudo-marketing influx. And that's what's being chosen and picked up by the mainstream radio stations. And my concern is, has it really been vetted? Has it been filtered by a group of people saying, hey, this sounds good?
Fair enough. No, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Clayton, can I toss that first to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think this actually relates back to a point that Kartik brought up when it came to Pandora. He mentioned that many users, because a song is recommended just because it shares overlapping features, if they've never heard the song before, then they explain why it doesn't sound very pleasing to them. So there's an effect in psychology that's been studied called the mirror exposure effect, which is sort of holding all else constant. So in to use the language of the caller, holding the objective quality of the song constant. If you've heard something before, you've been exposed to something before, then with repeated exposures, it starts to feel more familiar and also more positive. And so I think that's one phenomenon you see then here, especially with music. You hear a song a few times on the radio, it starts to feel catchier the more times that you hear it. And so songs that may, by objective standards, whatever we would agree that those are, might be less good just by virtue of the fact they're getting more radio play, that then starts to make them actually sound better to the listeners.
Kartik, what I hear Bob saying is that using college radio, I guess, which is a more sort of alternative, you know, nonconformist radio, back in the olden days, that would then be a feeder to the sort of more commercial stations, and voila, you know, some of these stars are born. He's saying if it's still really just all these recommender systems, have we lost that avenue to popularity, I guess, and fame?
Yeah, I think there's no doubt that the path to popularity or the path to mass appeal has changed. And there's going to be a new way, and it requires musicians and their promoters to be very savvy about social media and savvy about these taste-sharing algorithms and so on. Having said that, what is happening is it's a change in the way music is discovered, but I don't think we're necessarily moving from an environment where it was all about your quality and you managed to get through to a new environment where now quality doesn't matter, but rather the path of discovery is changing. And so I think they have to get savvy about these new ways of reaching their users. And there's going to be a phase where the ones who are savvy will get through. But eventually, I think it's going to again come down to all of them are using these these new marketing approaches, and it's just a new way of discovery.
Jerry from New Jersey joins us now on Radio Times. And Jerry, go ahead. You are on the air.
Hi. I had a similar comment, but maybe a slightly different angle from. I'm old enough to remember when radio stations weren't so categorized, and listening to one radio station, you could hear something from like very heavy rock and roll to something very heavy pop, and occasionally a country song, a wide variety of music. And sometimes I would find that I liked something that I didn't know that I would like. And then I learned things about myself because I was exposed to things that were very different than I ever would have thought to ask for.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, I used to play drums as a kid, and I used to go in a record store, and because I love drums, buy records that had drummers on the cover for no reason other than that. And it turned me into a jazz fan because those were the covers that had drummers on them, turned out to be all jazz bands, and I learned to really love jazz, which I never would have known. And so I'm worried that this algorithmic approach in some ways is not going to allow people to learn about themselves in the ways that we were forced to do in the past.
Jerry, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, a kind of serendipitous discovery, Kartik.
Yeah, I love that question. I think that's probably a bigger shift that's afoot, and it's not something that started today. As your caller mentioned, you know, we saw these radio shows and channels that are, you know, this is a jazz channel, that's a rock channel, and so on. And so that started a while back. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there's this Harvard professor, Cass Sunstein, he has a book called Republic.com, and he talks about this change in a context which has bigger consequences, politics. So he talks about how earlier there was just this one TV channel. You got all your news, whether it was right-leaning, left-leaning, everything on one show or one channel, and so you were exposed to all sides of any debate. But now I could just choose Fox News and only listen to that, or choose only MSNBC and only listen to that. I think that's a very valid point. I don't think it has necessarily it's tied to personalization systems. It's a broader change that has happened in society, and I think we all need to think hard about how do we break through these shackles, whether it is, you know, look for other sources of information, whether it comes to news or music or what have you, and maybe even design these systems to aid exploration.
And a minute before we have to say goodbye, Clayton, just a quick question to you. And I was looking at some articles about Netflix, and literally, how much Netflix knows about how we watch TV, when we pause, when we rewind something, when we fast forward something. I mean, we worry about the NSA knowing our habits, but it seems that the business has really mastered this much faster even than the government.
I think that's right. I mean, there was a huge scandal a few years ago when Netflix did their big competition to try to improve the recommendation system. People became very upset once it became learned that the data that Netflix released that was supposedly anonymized, they were able to trace that back to individual consumers. So yeah, I think it will be a question going forward whether consumers will appreciate the big welfare benefits that can come to consumer happiness from these type of recommendation systems, or these same concerns about privacy will start to creep up in the sphere as well.
Well, on that note, my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Clayton Critcher, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And Kartik Hosanagar, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program, including podcasts and Twitter, email, Facebook. It's all there for you to check it out. Ariel Plotnick's last day on Radio Times as an intern is today. Thanks, Ariel, for all your help this summer, your can-do attitude, and your show ideas. It was a pleasure having you as part of the Radio Times team. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.